It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama hosts Ukrainian Prime Minister and signal to Russia. China releases images of what could be parts of the missing plane. Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama has welcomed interim Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk to the White House as part of U.S. efforts to defuse the growing crisis between Washington and Moscow over the situation in Ukraine's Crimean region. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez filed this report.
U.S. officials say the president's invitation to Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk is clearly meant as a sign to Russia that Ukraine's new government has U.S. support and recognition. President Obama met with Mr. Yatsenyuk in the Oval Office before the two spoke with reporters. The U.S. leader said he hopes Russia, whose troops have overrun much of Ukraine's Crimea region, will change course. The U.S. leader praised what he said is the Ukrainian people's courage in defending democracy after weeks of demonstration forced out the old leadership supported by Moscow and brought in a government that seeks closer ties to Europe. The Ukrainian leader said his government wants a dialogue with Russia. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
China has released satellite images of what could be parts of a missing Malaysia airline plane floating in the South China Sea. Official Chinese media quote a government statement that says the satellite images were taken on Sunday, one day after the Boeing 777 disappeared. The images were not released until Wednesday. They show three fairly large objects floating in the sea between Malaysia and the southern tip of Vietnam, along with what was the jet's original flight path. It is difficult to tell what the objects are, and no one else involved in the investigation has confirmed what the images show. You can follow this developing story at voanews.com. A South African police forensic analysis says Oscar Pistorius was probably not wearing his prosthetic legs when he used a cricket bat to hit the door through which he fatally shot his girlfriend, an assertion that counters claims made by the athlete. In court testimony on Wednesday, Johan Vermilion said he believes Pistorius was on his stumps when he used the bat to try to break open the door last year after fatally shooting Riva Steenkamp. The door was set up in the courtroom as Vermilion described how marks on the bat matched one smaller and one larger hole in the door.
As I said in my evidence in chief, the marks matched with in a natural position without the legs of Mr. Pistorius. That the marks is consistent with him being in a natural position without these prosthesis.
Pistorius said in an affidavit during a bail hearing last year that he had put on the prosthetics prior to hitting the door with a cricket bat. Sudanese police have fired tear gas at protesters who called for revolution on Wednesday following the funeral for a student demonstrator. The chanting demonstrators took to the streets in Khartoum after about 1,000 people turned out for the student's funeral. The student died on Tuesday from injuries sustained during a protest against violence in the Darfur region. It's unclear how the student died. He was attending a protest at the University of Khartoum. Amnesty International says the student died of gunshot wounds after security forces used live ammunition and tear gas on demonstrators. In a statement, the Sudanese government said police only used tear gas during the protest. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says at least three people are dead and nine still missing after a blast caused by a gas leak destroyed two buildings in the Harlem neighborhood. At least 63 people were injured. De Blasio calls it a tragedy of the worst kind because it happened with no time to save people. The blast occurred shortly after someone in a nearby building called authorities to report smelling natural gas. Gas supplier Consolidated Edison sent two crews to the neighborhood, but they arrived just after the explosion happened. Thick smoke from the buildings could be seen through much of Manhattan. Debris littered sidewalks across the neighborhood and covered part of a commuter rail line, suspending train service. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says war is ripping Syria's rich cultural heritage to shreds. In a joint statement with UN Cultural Chief Irina Bokova and Special Representative Lakhdar Brahimi, Mr. Ban Wednesday said World Heritage Sites had suffered considerable and sometimes irreversible damage. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Thursday, March 13th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa's parliament passes a new gas and oil bill, but the opposition says it's bad for the country.
What this bill does is it effectively gives the government the power to nationalize up front anybody who makes a significant find of oil and gas. We believe that the bill has been set up to reward cronies and friends of the government.
James Leroman is a member of parliament and shadow minister of mineral resources for the opposition Democratic Alliance Party of South Africa. Protesting university students called for a revolution in Sudan. The judge in the trial of alleged coup plotters in South Sudan makes a request. And Sierra Leone reacts to a critical report on corruption.
As a government, we believe that it is only when we can sufficiently fight corruption that we can indeed set the country at the right direction.
Richard Conte is the chief of staff for President Ernest Bai Koroma of Sierra Leone and will tell you why Nigeria's once flourishing textile industry has failed. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance Party says an oil and gas bill passed by the African National Congress-dominated parliament would severely hurt the country's crucial mining and energy industry. The legislation passed Wednesday will give the state 20% ownership in investments and the right to buy an additional stake in new energy investments. James Lorema is a member of parliament and shadow minister of mineral resources for the Democratic Alliance Party. He tells me the bill will also cost South Africa investments and jobs.
South Africa is a traditional mining destination, and what this bill does in the mining sector is it gives extensive powers to the Minister of Mining to decide who gets mining licenses and under what terms those licenses are issued. And we believe it is going to result in capricious decision-making by the minister and ultimately a loss of confidence on the part of international investors in South Africa's mining industry. We believe that the bill has been set up to give the minister power to reward cronies and friends of the government. On the oil and gas side, the situation is even worse because although there is a belief that South Africa has significant reserves of oil and gas, both offshore in the deep water of South Africa's coast and onshore in the form of shale gas, what this bill does is it effectively gives the government the power to nationalize up front anybody who makes a significant find of oil and gas. So what we believe is going to happen is that all these major international energy companies, which are poised to start serious exploration of South Africa's resources, are simply going to pull out when faced with the prospect of nationalization.
This decision is coming almost 2 months or so before the South African general elections. Does your party suspect politics?
We do. We think that is part of it. The ruling African National Congress is facing a challenge from a couple of quite strongly left-wing parties. And we think it's perhaps to the electoral advantage of the ruling party that they can go back to voters and say, well, look, we are nationalizing the energy sector. And we think that'll play quite well with elements of the voting population.
In the wake of the mini strikes going on in South Africa, when we say, well, perhaps the government is listening to the people that the resources of the country have not been maybe equitably distributed, don't you think the ruling party is right also to do that?
No, absolutely not, because the unfortunate history of state control of mining operations is that they are inefficiently run. And when they are badly run, it means that the people who suffer in the end are the workers. We think that's exactly what is going to happen here. The workers are the people who are going to lose out because a lot of mining operations are going to close down as investment dries up, and many people will lose their jobs. And the great potential that the mining industry has to create jobs will never be realized.
Mining Minister Susan Shabangu has described people like you and your party as being stuck in the past because of your opposition.
Mining Minister Shabangu has many bad things to say about us, but she cannot answer the questions that we ask as to why the mining industry in South Africa is going backwards. It is shrinking, despite the fact that we have probably the richest mineral endowment of any country in the world. And we believe the reason for that is poor government regulation. And we believe that this bill that has just been passed is going to make things even worse.
James Lorimer is a member of parliament and shadow minister of mineral resources for the main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. He was speaking with me from Pretoria, South Africa. The trial of four people accused of trying to overthrow the government of South Sudan, President Salva Kiir, has been adjourned until March 19th. Meanwhile, the presiding judge in the case Wednesday requested that seven political detainees released last month into the custody of the Kenyan government must appear in the Juba courtroom when the trial resumes. Charlton Doki of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
During today's session, Justice James Alala Deng, head of the five-judge panel hearing the case, adjourned the trial of the four detainees until March 19th. Former SPLM Secretary General Pagan Amum Okech, former Security Minister Oyai Deng Ajak, former Deputy Defense Minister Majak Dagot Atem, and former South Sudan envoy to the U.S. Ezekiel Lol Gatkoth are accused of trying to overthrow the government. Judge Alala demanded that the seven men released in Kenya also appear in the court on the 19th. They include former Cabinet Affairs Minister Deng Alor Kwol, former Roads and Bridges Minister Gier Chuang Aluang, and former Finance Minister Kosti Manibe Ngai. Before adjourning the trial, the prosecution and defense questioned police investigator Major General Jackson Elia, who said a December press release from Riek Machar and other SPLM leaders incited the army to take up arms against the government on December 15th. Lead defense lawyer Monyiluak Alor expressed satisfaction with today's proceedings.
We look forward now to have the prosecution witnesses one by one. There are about 13 of them, so we'll see whether they will all come. And in the course of time, we will see if we have defense witnesses that we could invoke and bring to court. The defense witnesses will be worked out by the way the prosecution presented its case. So we are developing that.
A number of foreign lawyers were expected to join the defense team, but Alor says the government has not cleared them to take part in the trial.
The international lawyers, there are some of them, but they have not been accredited in the sense that their application has not been processed. So they are among the public. So there are observers among them that are legally competent and that would evaluate the process.
Security remained tight in and around the court premises, with one of the major roads leading to the venue completely shut down. Unlike yesterday, when hundreds of people stood outside the court, only a few dozen showed up today. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Sudanese police Wednesday fired tear gas at protesters calling for a revolution following the funeral of a student demonstrator. Student Ali Abakar died Tuesday from injuries sustained during a protest against violence in the Darfur region. Reporter Ishmael Kush of VOA South Sudan in Focus program says thousands of people took to the streets Wednesday calling for the removal of the government of President Omar al-Bashir.
Hundreds of protesters attended the funeral of Ali Abakar, a third-year economics student from Darfur, who was shot yesterday on campus following a protest organized by Darfur students who were protesting the recent escalation of violence in the region and the deteriorating humanitarian conditions there, which have led to the fleeing of tens of thousands in that troubled region. Darfur students accused students allied to the ruling National Congress Party of being responsible for the violence on campus, an allegation that NCP students denied. The Sudan police also denied involvement in the shooting of the students and said that it had fired tear gas but not live ammunition.
As you said, the violence has continued since yesterday, and today we have seen reports and tweets that mourners at the funeral clashed with the riot police when they were chanting slogans, you know, calling for the fall of the government. Tell me a little bit about that.
But thousands attend the funeral of the Ali Abakar this morning at Al-Sahafa Cemetery in Khartoum. And after the funeral, students and activists led a protest calling for the removal of the regime, calling for an uprising, and they were met by tear gas from dozens of security that had surrounded the cemetery. I spoke to someone who had witnessed and was passing by that said that the scene was incredible and that activists and students started running into different alleys as soon as the tear gas was fired against them.
That was in the Sahafa, like you said, and apparently the incident from yesterday sent anger waves across the capital. We heard that Khartoum University classes are suspended. How widespread is this reaction?
Classes have been suspended indefinitely at the University of Khartoum. We are hearing of protests at other campuses like Kulliyat al-Hadi, al-Mahdi, and al-Ahliya University in Omdurman. It's still not clear how widespread the reaction is. It has the potential to become wider. People were very angry that live ammunition was used on the campus of the University of Khartoum, which, of course, historically has been a hotbed for activism and politics in the country.
That's reporter Ismail Kouchkouch of VOA South Sudan in Focus program speaking with VOA fellow Nabil Biagio from Khartoum. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 13th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. The chief of staff for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma says no one will be spared in the government's quest to weed out endemic corruption. Richard Conte also rejects opposition criticism that the administration's efforts to fight corruption are a publicity stunt. In its corruption index, Transparency International says Sierra Leone had the highest incidences of bribery in Africa. The group said 84% of those polled in Sierra Leone admitted to paying bribe. Conte tells reporter Peter Clotty the government is implementing measures to combat corruption.
The government is very committed to the fight against graft. We do acknowledge it continues to be a problem, but we are determined to intensify the fight. In fact, in the first week of December, we'll be organizing a big conference to further create awareness about that. We are intensifying public awareness campaigns. We are, for example, ensuring that the service charters for all MDAs are put out on display so that when people come, they know what to expect. We are intensifying the efforts to try and capture people who are involved in corrupt practices and to bring them to book and to be able to punish them and take the appropriate legal measures to seek redress where applicable. And as a government, we believe that it is only when we can sufficiently fight corruption that we can indeed set the country at the right direction.
What do you say to critics who say that the recent corruption index is an embarrassment to the government, and that is why this government plans to make these efforts as a means to portray that it's doing something, but this is just a mere publicity stunt? What do you say to critics like that?
We are very concerned about that type of rating, but we do take note of the fact that it is more an issue of perception. Perceptions and realities do not always agree. What is true is that government is ensuring that it counts. It is that senior government officials found guilty of corruption are indicted. Where they are found guilty, they lose their jobs. And before even they are found guilty, they are relieved of their jobs pending the outcome of investigations. We as a government are committed to this fight, and we hope that our partners would also join us and support us in this fight against corruption.
Dr. Conte, you know as well as I do that the perception of corruption in the country could be a stumbling block to investors who would want to come and invest in the country that the country needs as part of its plan to employ the youth, among other government projects. What steps is your government willing to take to ensure that the government creates the enabling environment to attract foreign direct investors?
Well, I'm sure you know that our doing business credentials have been among the best in West Africa. We have succeeded over the past 5-6 years to increase our direct investment portfolio from less than $500 million to over $1 billion now and increasing. And on a daily basis, we receive expressions of interest, some unsolicited, from various investors wanting to come and invest in a range of sectors.
Richard Conte is chief of staff for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Freetown. Nigeria's once flourishing textiles industry and factories are decaying from lack of use. Some former workers say cheap clothes from China caused the collapse, but others blamed mismanagement and a lack of government support. Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from the northern city of Kaduna.
For the first time in more than a decade, these former textile workers are touring their old factory. Machines are decaying, and bits of cloth and other junk litter what used to be one of the largest factories in Nigeria. Wardum Simdek is chairman of the Coalition of Closed Unpaid Textile Workers in Kaduna.
Here in Kaduna, there is no any other job that these people are doing. The only job we are doing here is Okada's job. These people that ride motorcycle here and there. And at the end of the day, some of them, they got accident, they died.
Most of the clothes for sale in Nigeria are imported from China. Industry leaders say their low cost helped drive the textile factories out of business. But they stress that corruption, mismanagement, and lack of resources are equally to blame for the industry's collapse. Umar Mohammed, the former deputy secretary of the Textiles Workers Union, says they warned the government for years that without help, the factories would close.
Then at last, the industry will start collapsing one by one. To the extent today, in Kaduna, we have only two industries working, textile industry.
At the factory, former workers say about 9,000 of their ranks are waiting for back pay in Kaduna alone. And they insist that if the factories reopen, the locally made clothes will outsell the lower cost imports.
It was just mismanagement. Mismanagement. When I was working, people, our produce, people we are waiting to collect, people we are rushing to buy, we are unable to meet up with the demands.
Workers say failed industry in Kaduna affected more than the economy. This bridge separates Kaduna City, which is divided like the country as a whole, with mostly Christians in the south and mostly Muslims in the north. Clashes between the two groups are common. But former textile workers and their families say the violence is fueled by poverty that has intensified since the jobs disappeared. They fight for even small sums of money. Former textile workers say they will continue to protest outside the old factories and lobby for back pay. But returning to their jobs, they say, is still the dream. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Kaduna.
Researchers have developed a vaginal gel that is effective in protecting monkeys from infection with an AIDS-like virus. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, the main potential advantage of the microbicide for humans is that it can be applied by women after intercourse, even several hours later, increasing the likelihood that it will be used.
The vaginal gel was 84% effective in shielding a group of female rhesus macaques from infection with SHIV, a hybrid of HIV and the primate version of the virus. Four of the six monkeys treated with the gel up to 3 hours after exposure were protected against the virus, while all macaques in the placebo group became infected. The study reported in the journal Science Translational Medicine is the first to demonstrate the effect of a microbicide following sexual intercourse. Waleed Hanaini of the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was one of the lead investigators. He says the experimental compound, which contains the anti-HIV drug raltegravir, works by blocking the virus from integrating itself into cells and replicating after it enters the body.
We showed that this step takes more than 6 hours, and therefore provides ample time for dosing or for treatment with the gel vaginally. And we showed in the CAC model that this modality works and protects animals from infection.
His team also found that the monkeys were protected from SHIV when the gel was used a half hour before exposure to the virus. Before starting clinical trials, researchers need to confirm that the microbicide would offer similar protection against HIV in humans. If it does, say experts, it could put women in better control of their health. According to Melissa Robiani, director of biomedical HIV research at the Population Council in New York, women would not have to negotiate with their partners about protection against the deadly virus.
Pre-treatment or pre-dosing of a product, in this case a gel, presumably is more cumbersome to the woman, and maybe a post-exposure regimen, as is suggested from these studies, would be more acceptable because they would potentially be able to do it in the absence of their partner knowing.
Gauging the microbicide's acceptance and ease of use will be an important part of the clinical trials once they begin. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on football. Malawi has pulled out of the qualifying contest for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The Football Association of Malawi president Walter Nyimilandu revealed in Lilongwe on Wednesday. He clarified that this measure is due to lack of funds to honor their fixtures during the qualifiers. Instead, Malawi will focus on the under-20 competitions and grassroots development. On a more cheerful note, the Uganda national football team, the Cranes, has secured over $365,000 in sponsorship from the Uganda National Insurance Corporation, NIC, ahead of the qualifiers for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The NIC managing director for Layan Bayo told the Kampala media on Wednesday. Uganda Football Federation head Moses Magogo says 33 members of the Cranes playing unit and technical crew will enjoy insurance cover. He says this is an important motivation for the team. Meanwhile, the Nigerian Senate is set to approve a budget of US$12 million for the Nigeria Super Eagles 2014 World Cup campaign in Brazil. The Nigeria Senate Committee on Sports and Social Development head Adamu Ibrahim Gumba revealed in Abuja on Wednesday. He showered praise on the work of the Nigeria Football Federation, who over the past 2 years has presided over significant success in Nigeria's international campaigns. These include winning the Orange Africa Cup of Nations, the FIFA Under-17 World Cup, and Nigeria's qualifying for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. In addition, Nigeria has also qualified for the FIFA Women's Under-17 and Under-20 World Cup. Adamu says these successful feats have persuaded the Senate to look favorably at the Federation's budget request for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. Finally, a Confederation of African Football inspection team led by South African Molefe Olifant began on Wednesday a four-day inspection tour of Namibia's preparation to host the Africa Women's Championships in October. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Thursday morning comes from Mohamed Ahmed Masuo of Monrovia, Liberia. He writes, "Dear Daybreak Africa, the trial of Oscar Pistorius for the killing of his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp is an indication that nobody is above the law. I hope Mr. Pistorius will be given a free and fair trial. However, the culture of impunity must be eradicated from the continent so that people who commit acts of violence can be made to account for their crimes." We thank you, Mohamed Ahmed Masuo of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Sudanese police have fired tear gas at protesters who called for revolution on Wednesday following the funeral for a student demonstrator. The chanting demonstrators took to the streets in Khartoum after about 1,000 people turned out for student Ali Abakar Musa Idris' funeral. The student died on Tuesday from injuries sustained during a protest against violence in Sudan's Darfur region. And that's it for this Thursday, March 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very lovely Thursday.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.